around the world with reporters.
The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela might be about to break relations with the Kingdom of Spain after Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro announced he would review relations of all kinds with the European country due to what he calls their improper and disrespectful actions against Venezuela. Experts say that Spain, among members of the European Union, is regarded as the most important influence in the European policy toward the nations of Latin America. In the light of rising political tensions between Caracas and Madrid, Maduro denounced recent hostile actions from the Spanish government of Pedro Sanchez, including the Spanish Foreign Minister Arancha Gonzalez, who last Saturday visited the border between Colombia and Venezuela and criticized the situation of Venezuelan migrants in the zone. The visit by the top Spaniard diplomat in Colombia was strongly decried by Maduro, saying that Spain must stay away from his country's internal issues.
I condemn Spain's meddling actions. Such a mistaken conduct will be punished by my administration.
Meanwhile, on the opposition side, many backed the Spanish move, alleging the European country must intervene in Venezuela's problems.
Spain's speaking in favor of Venezuelan migrants who flee our homeland due to Maduro's failed regime.
However, Venezuelan officials insist the Spanish move is politically motivated and therefore will not be tolerated.
Spain and the European Union must rectify their hostile political stance on Venezuela, or else relations will break up.
Maduro has remarked that relations with Spain in all areas will be fully examined by him, as the Spanish meddling in Venezuela's affairs is unacceptable. He blames Madrid over imitating the U.S. hostility and claims Venezuela will respond accordingly. Asusila Paracas.
Lab rats have always been used as guinea pigs for testing brand new medicine. But when it comes to the coronavirus, the story is different. Mice cannot be infected with the coronavirus, since they do not have the receptor that hosts the virus. To scientists, however, there's always a way. Iran's Royan Institute, which specializes in biomedical and stem cell research, has created transgenic mice with a human receptor on their cells. The receptor, called ACE2, is the one that the coronavirus uses to make its way into human cells. This means the genetically modified mice can now catch the virus.
We transferred a human version of this receptor called ACE2 to the mice, and now our transgenic mice can basically get the virus, can get the disease COVID-19, and they are a good model for the basically studies that aim to investigate drugs, medical procedures.
The transgenic mice can be used to understand unexpected clinical manifestations of the coronavirus infection in humans.
It will be useful for those aspects of COVID-19 which are basically more or less unknown right now. And we hope that it will uncover more details about the disease process itself, and also it will be useful for other possible new types of coronavirus which may appear in future years.
Experts at Royan Institute say the mice can also be used as a viable stand-in for humans in testing potential vaccines and therapeutics.
Basically, any types of vaccine which is proposed for this specific disease can be used on these mice. So we are providing these mice for other researchers in the country to use it before they try it on human, and they can get more information from the mice, because you can easily dissect mice and see what's happening inside the bodies, the organs. You can't do that with human, right?
Royan Institute is currently developing its own COVID vaccine. The preclinical stages will involve testing the vaccine on the genetically modified mice. Royan's vaccine is one of the 8 jabs Iran is developing. 2 of them have so far made their way to the human trial phase.
Since the virus struck in Iran,
Ruoyang Institute has stepped in to join the fight against COVID-19 by mass-producing test kits. And now that its vaccine is lagging behind in the race with its domestic rivals. The leading biotech firm says lab results show that the vaccine is a promising candidate. It will soon enter the animal trial phase. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The U.S. has finally released a long-awaited report on the gruesome murder of Jamal Khashoggi, confirming that the Crown Prince had personally approved an operation to capture or kill him. Accordingly, the U.S. says it has imposed sanctions against Saudi Arabia over the murder. However, Washington's restrictions only target members of the Saudi Royal Guard's Rapid Intervention Force, not their patron and commander, Mohammed bin Salman. That once again exposes Washington's double standard in dealing with criminals, despite its own intelligence assessment that Khashoggi was killed and his body dismembered at the behest of bin Salman in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. The UN has reacted to the CIA report, saying the U.S. fails to take practical steps to hold the main culprit accountable.
With the release of the U.S. report confirming Saudi officials' culpability at the highest levels, the United States should now take the lead in ensuring accountability for this crime and for setting in place the international mechanisms to prevent and punish such acts in the future. The United States government should impose sanctions against the Crown Prince as it has done for the other perpetrators, targeting his personal assets but also his international engagements.
Reactions are also pouring in from other authorities and legal experts who have dismissed the U.S. report as too little, too late.
This is not enough. The Crown Prince needs to face accountability. He needs to face sanctions, asset freezes, travel bans.
Analysts are also criticizing the White House for failing to take the Saudi Crown Prince to account.
Nobody saw the actual report until now. And yes, it's confirmed that indeed, as the Saudis say, a rogue operative was responsible. And that rogue is bin Salman himself.
Many believe Washington's failure to hold bin Salman accountable is due to its interests. Even the U.S. itself has admitted that it is seeking its own interests in maintaining a close partnership with Riyadh.
I would say the relationship with Saudi Arabia is an important one. We have significant ongoing interests. We remain committed to the defense of the kingdom. And so what we've done by the actions that we've taken is really not to rupture the relationship, but to recalibrate it.
In fact, decades-old U.S.-Saudi nexus have benefited the both, with Riyadh spending its petrodollars for American arms and Washington hatching plots to destabilize the region for its own sake. The U.S. backing for the Saudi regime's deadly mayhem in Yemen over the past 5 years is part of such plots. If the new U.S. administration claims that it really wants to break with the policies of the Trump government, it should walk the walk rather than talk the talk and stop supporting the al-Saud regime that has a long history of malign disregard for not only its own citizens like Khashoggi, but even the impoverished people like Yemenis.
The racial disparities in who gets a dose of the desperately wanted coronavirus vaccine continues to roil the United States. African Americans compose 12% of the U.S. population, yet they have only received 5% of the vaccines. 60% of America is white, and they have gotten 60% of the vaccines. The mainstream media is repeatedly blaming the problem on African Americans by emphasizing their mistrust of the federal government due to a shocking national history of medical experimentation on black communities. However, the small share of whites and blacks who say they refuse to ever get vaccinated is the same, 14%. Multiple studies point to a simpler explanation. Vaccines are overwhelmingly being sent to white neighborhoods. In the United States, vaccines are being issued at places like pharmacies, clinics, and hospitals. But perpetual underinvestment in lower class and non-white areas means many black communities simply don't have this medical infrastructure. Similarly, African American and poor neighborhoods don't have adequate schools, roads, businesses, work opportunities, and many other basic requirements for healthy living. Since almost the start of the pandemic, it's been clear that non-whites are drastically overrepresented in the so-called essential worker occupations. and that non-whites are four times more likely to be hospitalized by corona and three times more likely to die from it.
And then we also have a lot of our Southside hospitals that are closing and can't meet the demand if they were to get the shipment. They don't have anywhere to store them. So that's another reason. A lot of our clinics are being closed in the inner community. It's time to get the boots on the ground. It's time to show faith by coming into the black communities, setting up pop-up shops for vaccines.
Latino Americans are getting only 11% of vaccines, despite being 18% of the population. The failure to equally share coronavirus vaccines with all classes is expected to further exacerbate the nation's long-standing socioeconomic inequalities, which the pandemic continues to reveal. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Like millions of other young people in the EU, Charles Prevost feels he has not been given adequate support by authorities during the pandemic. In order to survive, the entrepreneur has purchased his own hot dog stand, which he operates in Brussels.
I was working on a restaurant. I was managing a restaurant and I lost my job, and I was like, what I can do? What I can do next? What we can do? What the young people, the young men, the young ladies in this world, in this city, in this country, what they can do, because we don't have any help.
As businesses continue to fold in the EU and millions lose their jobs, people feel there is no hope. Only 6.4% of the bloc's population have received a vaccine. That's tiny compared to the UK and US. A two-day video conference involving EU leaders has just concluded. They are very concerned about COVID-19 mutations.
The B.1.1.7 is by now in all member states but one. The South African variant is in 14 member states and the Brazilian variant in 7. So there's a lot of challenge ahead of us.
Variants are allowed to flourish when people are not vaccinated. Experts say the bureaucratic structures of the EU have resulted in citizens having to wait far too long for vaccines. However, EU leaders say producers are not keeping their promises in terms of supply.
We want more predictability and transparency to ensure that pharmaceutical companies comply with their commitments.
Health officials warn mixed messages from EU leaders about the efficacy of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine are making citizens reluctant to take the jab. Two other vaccines have been approved here, but supply remains a big problem. A fourth vaccine from Johnson & Johnson is likely to be approved next month. During their summit, EU leaders talked at length about the importance of developing certificates to show people have been vaccinated in order to open up travel. Commentators are describing this as laughable, saying it is putting the cart before the horse, given the current state of play with respect to the rollout of vaccines. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Rome's Association of Palestinians called a sit-in in the vicinity of the Italian parliament to draw attention on Israel's COVID-19 vaccine program, which excludes the nearly 5 million Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza Strip under Israeli military occupation. The rally was supported by a number of left-wing groups and unions.
The fourth Geneva Convention stipulates that Israel has a responsibility as an occupying power to ensure that medical aid reaches the occupied territories to combat the coronavirus crisis. Responsibilities also include providing vaccines in a non-discriminatory manner to Palestinians under its control.
Israel ha l'obbligo. Israel has the duty to provide COVID vaccines to Palestinians. The question is why nobody talks about it here in Italy. TVs and newspapers praise Israel's vaccination campaign, but they don't say a word about how Israel is a militarized country which is not observing its international obligations and pays each vaccine dose double the price, promising pharmaceutical companies patient data.
While Palestinians' right to health care is undermined, Tel Aviv has pledged to send thousands of spare coronavirus vaccines to foreign allies that have accepted Israeli sovereignty in Jerusalem, such Czech Republic, Hungary, and Honduras.
These vaccine donations are the latest example of Israel's new expression of soft power. Tel Aviv rewards or sways those that have little access to vaccines in exchange for their complicity. This confirms the absence of morals and values of Israel.
We are calling on Italy, the EU and international community to take concrete measures to force Israel to provide Palestinians with vaccines. We are not begging, we demand what is ours.
In January, the United Nations voiced its concern over Israel's refusal to vaccinate the Palestinians, but the appeal has gone unheard so far. Max Civili, Rome.
Across South Korea, vaccinations against COVID-19 began, with more than 5,000 nursing home residents and care providers scheduled to get their jabs by the end of the day.
I was thinking of the elderly patients at our nursing home who have been exhausted and sad about not being able to see their families, so I'm glad to be the first person to be vaccinated. I hope herd immunity is established so that our patients can see their families and everyone can return to daily life without masks.
President Moon Jae-in observed people getting their shots, seeking to encourage people to be vaccinated when it's their turn. South Korean officials say the country should achieve herd immunity by November of this year. Herd immunity is achieved when a high percentage of people have been immunized, preventing the spread of a contagious disease. But about half of South Koreans surveyed are hesitant to get their shots. South Korea had been successful in limiting the spread of COVID-19 during the initial outbreak a year ago, but has seen waves of the virus infect hundreds of people each day since November last year.
There are many reasons why I will get my shot right away, but I think during the last year of COVID-19, the government has done well to prevent it spreading, so I trust them in terms of the vaccine.
South Korea has received vaccines, but I'm hesitant to get it. It's because in the UK, many cases of side effects have been reported, so I'm a bit reluctant. I want to watch what happens, and I'll get it if it's okay then.
Seoul's November goal of herd immunity may also be complicated by supply chain challenges and drug-resistant variants of COVID-19, with a return to normality more likely in 2022. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The nursery home in the vicinity of Tehran. People are waiting to receive the first dose of their COVID-19 jab. At this phase, which is the second, the elderly and those with underlying diseases and the disabled will get the vaccine. The country's health minister, Said Namaki, attended the retirement home in Tahrirzak to launch the campaign. He told reporters that these people will be vaccinated free of charge.
Fortunately, today the second phase of corona vaccination began across the country. At this stage, in addition to people working at the ICUs of the hospitals and the more vulnerable ones, the elderly will get the jab. We launched a campaign here at Tahrirzak Nursery Home, but as of tomorrow, at most of the nursery centers, this will continue.
Press TV asked the minister when the normal people will take the vaccine, and he answered that hopefully by September, most of the Iranians will be vaccinated.
Based on the priorities, first off the healthcare staff and then the elderly and people with specific diseases, as well as those injured during the Iran-Iraq war, will be inoculated. Afterwards, it comes to the normal people, and I think most of the target groups will get the shot by mid-September.
We also interviewed the head of Iran's welfare organization, who told us that in the first stage, some 20,000 doses will be allocated to nursery centers across the country.
Over 14,000 elderly people are receiving services at nursery homes across Iran. Out of them, over 3,000 were infected, but some 2,200 got well, 506 people are under treatment, and unfortunately, 375 ones lost their lives despite our efforts. At this center, 1,400 aged and disabled people will be vaccinated within 2 days.
The Islamic Republic kicked off the first phase of COVID-19 vaccination with administering the jab on medical staff working at some 600 hospitals across the country. Iranian health officials say indigenously produced shots will be used in the later stages of the campaign. Over 110,000 people have been vaccinated up to now. Iran has so far logged more than 1.6 million COVID-19 cases with over 59,800 deaths.
Iran began its COVID-19 vaccination program on February 9th. The top priority group of vaccination are doctors and nurses who are working at intensive care units of the hospitals. The next group are these elderly people and the ones with underlying diseases. Human Abedi, Chahrizak.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Donald Trump on Sunday launched his attempted political comeback, teasing a possible run for the presidency in 2024 and denouncing current President Joe Biden for the most disastrous first month of any president in modern history. The former president made his first speech since leaving the White House at the right-wing Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, in Orlando, Florida, to an effusive reception. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist David Smith. The piece is titled CPAC, Pent-Up Trump Denounces Biden at Right-Wing Summit. Stay with us for more of David Smith's article. Donald Trump on Sunday launched his attempted political comeback, teasing a possible run for the presidency in 2024 and denouncing Joe Biden for the most disastrous first month of any president in modern history. The former president made his first speech since leaving the White House at the right-wing Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, in Orlando, Florida, to an effusive reception. Trump claimed, entirely falsely, that he actually won the 2020 presidential election, but was fraudulently denied his victory. He told CPAC the Democrats just lost the White House, despite the fact that Joe Biden was inaugurated as the 46th President of the United States on 20th of January, sworn in by the Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, and officials at all levels called the election the most secure in U.S. history. Trump said to wild cheers, "I may even decide to beat them for a third time." The twice impeached ex-president unleashed pent-up frustration after 2 months of social media silence. He was banned by both Facebook and Twitter for incendiary comments and just a handful of television interviews. Donald Trump made it clear he intends to remain a political force by declaring, "I stand before you today to declare that the incredible journey we began together 4 years ago is far from over. We all knew that the Biden administration was going to be bad, but none of us imagined just how bad they would be and how far left they would go. Joe Biden has had the most disastrous first month of any president in modern history." Donald Trump added, "Biden's radical immigration policies aren't just illegal, They're immoral, they're heartless, and they are a betrayal of our nation's core values. Donald Trump also called on Joe Biden to reopen schools despite ongoing safety fears due to the coronavirus pandemic. The former president also invoked his America First nationalist agenda by insisting, "We believe in standing up to China, shutting down outsourcing, bringing back our factories and supply chains, and ensuring that America, not China, dominates the future." In a speech that lasted about 90 minutes, Donald Trump fell back on his reliable right-wing themes against immigration, especially dealing harshly with migrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, and talking up his barrier strengthening there. He also took off on a transphobic rant, claiming that transgender athletes were ruining women's sports. And Donald Trump positioned himself at the presumed heart of the Republican Party, saying any idea that he was going to lead a breakaway political party was fake news. Despite the recent bipartisan vote at his impeachment trial, where he escaped conviction, Trump claims the Republican Party is united. The only division is between a handful of Washington, D.C. establishment political hacks and everybody else all over the country. Most commentators expect Donald Trump, age 74, to leave open the possibility that he will run for re-election in 2024 without making a definitive commitment. He has remained a looming presence at CPAC, with speaker after speaker pledging fealty to him and his Make America Great Again agenda, while a golden calf-style idol in his image was even paraded around the convention halls. Numerous speakers and panels have also indulged and prompted Donald Trump's brazen lie that the election was stolen from him. Matt Schlapp, chair of the American Conservative Union, which runs the conference, claimed, "CPAC is your first opportunity to see what actually happened on election day, and there was widespread voter fraud in way too many states, most especially in big cities run by the Democratic machine. That is fact, and we gave you evidence to underscore that fact." Tom Fitton, president of the right-wing group Judicial Watch, told attendees, "On election day, President Trump had the votes to win the presidency. These vote totals were changed because of unprecedented and extraordinary counting after election day." Judicial Watch has long warned of the chaos and increased risk of fraud from recklessly mailing 100 million ballots and ballot applications. Such claims have repeatedly been proved false. Mail-in voting surged because of the coronavirus pandemic, but state officials, including Republicans, reported no significant irregularities in the vote. The former president and his allies lost more than 60 legal challenges, including those weighed by Trump-appointed judges. Donald Trump's own Attorney General, William Barr, dismissed the fraud allegations. The former president rounded off his speech with another tease about his future ambitions, telling the crowd, "With your help, we will take back the White House. We will win the Senate, and then a Republican president will make a triumphant return to the White House. And I wonder who that will be. I wonder who that will be. Who will that be? I wonder." Earlier on Sunday, 28th of February, the Republican Congressman Jim Jordan said of Trump, "The leader of the conservative movement, the leader of the America First movement, the leader of the Republican Party, and I hope on 20th of January 2025, he will be once again the leader of our great country." But the annual CPAC straw poll found that only 55% of attendees actually want Donald Trump to be the Republican presidential nominee in 2024, ahead of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis at 21%, the conference, the CPAC conference, of course, was held in Florida, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem at 4%, and former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley at 3%. Evan McMullen, executive director of Stand Up Republic and a former presidential candidate, tweeted in response, "It's still Donald Trump's party, but there's a growing number ready for something new." Meanwhile, for all the talk of party unity, CPAC was notable for the absence of former Vice President Mike Pence and absence of Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and a number of other leading Republicans. Bill Cassidy, a Republican senator from Louisiana, insisted that CPAC does not represent the entire Republican Party. Bill Cassidy said, "Now, if we plan to win in midterm elections in 2022, and a presidential election in 2024, we have to listen to the voters, not just those who really like President Trump, but also those who perhaps are less sure," he told CNN's State of the Union program. Cassidy added, "If we idolize one person, we will lose, and that's kind of clear from the last election."
The debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kavitat Wade. The twists and turns of the Iran nuclear file continues unabated. In the latest, the Europeans have pushed an IAEA Iran resolution, anti-Iran resolution, despite warnings by Russia and Tehran. This comes from the same countries who were supposed to actually adhere to their commitments when the U.S. pulled out of the Iran 2015 nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA. In this edition of the debate, we will look at whether the Europeans and the U.S. are now in one camp, and why the E3 has changed its tune in this way when it comes to Iran. First, let's find out what is actually going on. From Vienna, our correspondent Homa Leski joins us. Well, Homa, since the last time we spoke, we have had France actually make a statement regarding how it's going to still pursue some kind of path to resolve this. Is that representative of what the E3 or the EU stance is at this point? And, of course, any other developments that may have occurred since then?
Yes, Carver, as you say, the IAEA Board of Governors session has begun. It's convened today, and it will be ongoing in the next few days. And just as it started, news came out that these three Europe signatories to the nuclear deal, the JCPOA, have circulated a draft resolution to the other board members. And that resolution, which has been backed by the United States, criticizes Iran on a number of issues, including Iran's decision to restrict its cooperation with the IAEA, to restrict the agency's access, and to suspend the implementation of the additional protocol, and also concerning some questions that the agency has raised about Iran and the uranium particles found in undeclared sites in Iran. And this criticism and this resolution is coming at a very critical time. And this is why the Russian ambassador here, also in a paper that was distributed, or a note that was given to members of the IAEA, said that Moscow would oppose this resolution, would not vote for it, and believes that at this time it will just complicate the process for efforts to revive the JCPOA, and it will, in the words of the Russian ambassador, also undermine the normal cooperation that exists between Iran and the agency. When Mr. Grossi was asked about this today in the press conference, He said that the IAEA should remain impartial and should not give any political opinion, but he did make it clear that what he wants in any political arrangement or any negotiations is for the agency to be able to continue its work in Iran. It will be a big blow to the current level of ties if the JCPOA does indeed collapse. And now, as you say there, the Europeans on the one hand saying that they are serious about reviving the deal, on the other hand making this extra pressure on Iran and putting this extra pressure on Iran at the IAEA headquarters here at the Board of Governors session, because if this resolution is passed, Iran has said there will be consequences, there will be countermeasures. Will Iran scrap its current temporary technical understanding that it's reached with the agency? What will those countermeasures be? Iran hasn't been very specific about them, but it is definitely going to influence the situation and impact the process of this political negotiation that's not very, at the moment, going anywhere.
When is that going to actually be voted on or looked at, this resolution? I believe it's Friday, if I'm correct.
Well, it depends, because there are a number of issues on the agenda at the Board of Governors session. Iran is not the first issue on the agenda. Today, the press conference of Director General Grossi, which usually it's probably tomorrow, but as you say, either Thursday, Friday, it depends on the progress that these discussions take. At that level, at that time, when the Iran issue does come up, then we'll hear more also from the Iranian ambassador here. He probably will deliver his own statement, and we'll see if actually there is an agreement, if actually members decide to vote on the resolution, and if indeed they do vote, if they will be able to adopt it.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Komolensky there from Vienna. All right, let's bring in journalist and author Daniel Lazar from New York. Daniel Lazar, welcome. You know, this move by France, Germany, and the UK pressing ahead with the U.S.-backed plan for a resolution by the UN Nuclear Watchdogs Board, criticizing Iran for curbing cooperation with the agency. Why do you think that they have taken this type of stance when the situation, as fragile as it is, could derail maybe any hopes for trying to solve this the situation?
Well, I mean, all the parties, all sides, the U.S. and the Europeans, are very weak and irresolute at this moment. Biden is torn. He doesn't really know what he wants. His foreign policy team is in disarray. They're not sure if they want to go forward with the negotiations or halt them while they place additional demands on Iran. Apparently, the debate about that is still going on behind the scenes. The Europeans just want to repair relations with the U.S. after the Trump years and get everything back to normal, but that means trying to compromise with the U.S. and do its bidding, and that's not working either. I'm extremely pessimistic about the JCPOA negotiations. I don't think they'll succeed. I think the treaty is heading to defeat, to an early demise. And I think what we're seeing now is the process of collapse that is ongoing.
Okay, let me bring in George Samueli from Budapest. He's a senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, who joins us. George Samueli, welcome. Our guest there, Daniel Lazar, saying that he's not optimistic at all. And he believes that this thing is really unraveling. At this point, we're seeing a move, in a sense, an anti-Iran move by the E3. Although, just in the past hour, we've had France come and say, as disappointed as they are going to look for some type of path to try to see if they can resolve this. Why do you think the E3 made this move at this point, George Samueli?
Well, for the Europeans, they are much more interested in maintaining their relations with the United States than they are in adhering to the JCPOA. I mean, they made an endless number of promises to Iran back when the JCPOA was being negotiated that should the United States walk away, and that was always expected, should the United States walk away and restore sanctions, the E3 would go out of their way to alleviate the pain that Iran would suffer as a consequence. This never happened, despite all the promises that they would set up a financial mechanism to alleviate the pain of Iran. It never materialized. And this was back in the Trump years. So this had nothing to do with their feelings about Trump and trade or anything like that. So they never did anything about it. Now, again, you know, to them it's more important to keep in with Washington than it is to do anything for Iran. And so therefore, it's if, now that it's clear that the Biden administration isn't going to do anything very much to return to the JCPOA, I mean, they'll talk a good game. Yes, we're prepared to go back in as long as Iran returns to its side of the deal. Well, let's remember, Iran was not the one that walked away. Iran never violated the JCPOA. It was the United States that did so. So it is an absurdity for the United States to make any of these demands that Iran somehow must make the first step. And the Europeans should know this. And instead, the Europeans are making these noises that, yes, 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 Iran must return to the limits imposed by the JCPOA. Well, of course, it's an absurdity. And, you know, time and again, like as you mentioned about what Monsieur Macron has said, yeah, time and again, the Europeans flap their hands and say, yes, yes, we definitely must go back to the JCPOA and we must do something. But nothing ever materializes. But I think, as your previous guest pointed out, I think the JCPOA is a dead letter.
Okay. If we want to take a look at what France has said, Daniel Azar, you know, again, saying that it's disappointed with what Iran has done, but yet it's going to look for a way to try to see if we can solve this, which is, in a sense, what the EE3 wants to also do. It almost makes one lead to concluding, in one sense, that perhaps we're looking at posturing, even though Iran has every right, by many accounts, to make its demand and make it clear, as it did just days ago when it said it would not participate in a European Union proposal to hold a meeting with the U.S. and the other parties of the deal. Do you think this is all about posturing right now?
Well, it's not posturing on Iran's account. I mean, I think that's really unfair to Iran, which is the aggrieved party in this case. I mean, it was the U.S. which unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, leaving Iran with very few options, especially since the Europeans refused to counter the U.S. walkout. Now Iran is doing what it feels it has to do. The U.S. is engaging in posturing, saying on one hand that it wants to rejoin the JCPOA, while on the other hand refusing to do so. And clearly, the name of the U.S. game is putting the blame on Iran if the negotiations fall through, as they likely will. So that's what U.S. posturing means. It means a phony attempt to show that it is loyal to the JCPOA while setting Iran up for a fall and trying to convince the world that Iran is responsible. This is extremely dangerous, and I think it's going to lead to some kind of military crisis in the Persian Gulf, which is the last thing that anyone should want.
Well, before we get to that angle or to that issue, George Samioli, the IAEA Director General, made a statement that the inspection work at the firm or the organization should not be put in the middle of a negotiating table as a bargaining chip. Now, given the fact that you have Britain, France, and Germany pressing ahead, and I mentioned this in the beginning of the program, with a U.S.-backed plan for a resolution by the U.N. Nuclear Board of Governors, a U.S.-backed plan, what does that U.S.-backed plan mean? Does it mean that the E3 came up with it, the U.S. backed it, or the U.S. came up with it, the E3 presented it, and went forward with it?
Well, I think it's the latter. I think the U.S. Drafted a plan and then laundered it through the Europeans, so it seems like a European plan. Look, it's not complicated. If the United States was really serious about returning to the JCPOA, it could easily make a goodwill gesture of lifting some of the sanctions. to say, okay, we're going to lift some of the sanctions. Let's now move on a step-by-step process of returning to the JCPOA. The United States hasn't done so. Instead, the Europeans and the Americans are now presenting a line of argument that somehow it's Iran's fault, it's Iran that isn't adhering to the JCPOA, and that we need to renegotiate that agreement so that, we'll return, the United States will return to the JCPOA, but in return, Iran will have to make concessions, both about its ballistic missiles program and about its regional influence. Well, Iran's not going to do it. Iran is not going to return to an agreement that is worse from Iran's point of view than the one that it signed in 2015, particularly when there's no guarantee that this agreement will be adhered to by the United States at all. I mean, let's remember, there's a reasonable chance that Donald Trump will be back in 2024, or another Republican will be elected in 2024, and then the United States will again withdraw from the JCPOA. So what's the incentive for Iran to return? Now, yes, sanctions are certainly painful, but Iran does have friends and allies who have done something to help out Iran economically, namely Russia and China, above all China. So for Iran now to make a decision, well, if we return to the JCPOA, we have to then give up our ballistic missiles program, and we have to give up our regional allies. Well, that's an existential issue for Iran. I mean, its ballistic missiles are vital for its defense, and its regional allies are vital for its defense. It's not going to give those things up in order to return to an agreement that it has no reasonable basis to believe the Americans will adhere to.
Okay, you talked about war, Daniel Lazar, as a possibility here if agreement obviously is not made or if this thing is not solved. And haven't the parties been down this path before they struck that deal, the JCPOA deal? I mean, you know, there was a lot of tension, and you had accusations flying around on Iran from, you name it. And, of course, Israel had some hand in the way that it was demonizing Iran. But, you know, that path has been traveled. So don't you think that diplomacy here should prevail somehow, and for this deadlock to, be solved before that path or that result comes about?
Of course it should be. There should be no diplomacy should take hold. But the U.S. and its allies seem to be dead set against it. I mean, look, you're right. I mean, Iran is, I mean, a war is something that always is being predicted in the Persian Gulf. I mean, I've predicted five of the last two wars myself. So we can't be sure what the future holds. We don't know what the parties will do. Israel is engaging in some very serious sword rattling, but you know that just may be all for show, an attempt to throw Iran off balance. We can't be sure, but I do believe that if the JCPOA does fall through once and for all, that the gloves will be off and the chances of a military conflict will rise significantly. Beyond that, we can't predict anything, but that itself seems clear enough. And you're right, that is all the reason, all the more reason to continue down the diplomatic path.
Do you think that is where this is going to end up, George Samueli? And when our guest talks about military conflict, what type of military conflict between whom would that happen if something like this happens?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because remember, during the Trump years, there was a frequently cited prediction that there will be a military conflict between the United States and Iran, and it seemed like that was a possibility following the assassination of General Soleimani. However, if you recall, the Trump administration backed off. It allowed Iran to retaliate, lobbing missiles at U.S. forces, and the United States did not retaliate back, which is a first. I mean, the United States doesn't just let that go, being attacked, its troops being attacked. It nonetheless let it go because it didn't want to get into a war with Iran. I have my doubts that there'll be a war with Iran. It's not a war that the United States is in any real position to win very easily. I mean, you know, it can't invade Iran. Iran's just much too big and powerful a country to invade. It can lob missiles at Iran, but Iran can retaliate, and not even necessarily against the United States. I mean, it can retaliate in the Persian Gulf against Saudi Arabia, against the Gulf states. It can bring the entire oil, the global oil industry to a standstill. This is not something that the United States wants to happen. Now, of course, things could spiral out of control. The Biden administration looks very weak and indecisive at the moment. No one really knows who exactly is running the show there. So it's a possibility. I don't necessarily think that a war with Iran is likely, and certainly not with Israel. Israel wants others to fight its wars for it. It doesn't like fighting countries that can fight back. I mean, it likes, making these raids on Gaza, it raids in Lebanon, it raids in Syria. It has no intention of taking on a major power like Iran. So, Israel would quite like to provoke a conflict with between the United States and Iran, but it's not going to get involved in a direct war itself.
Okay. The elections in Iran is going to be coming up soon, Daniel Lazar. And, of course, there's some camps out there, maybe in the U.S. perhaps, that may think, why should the type of negotiations on this obviously very important issue be happening with the current government, and it should happen with the next Iranian government. Of course, Iran is not going to stand for that length of time to surpass. At this point, it is given that deadline, which it will cross out if this resolution at the Board of Governors is going to be passed. Is there a possibility that we're looking at the U.S. perhaps taking that stance along maybe with the E3, or is that not the case?
It's very hard to tell. I mean, I agree with George that the whole bunch of factors that work here and adding them up involves some very complicated arithmetic. The U.S., but I think the U.S. government is in disarray. Biden doesn't really know what he wants. But I think if the U.S. thinks we'll gain anything by putting the negotiations off for 3 or 4 months, I think it's sadly mistaken. Because whatever new government comes into power in Iran, I think that the one conclusion it will draw from this whole sorry experience is that negotiations with the United States are really pointless, and there is no reason to go down that road again.